Revelation chapter 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away." Lord's Word. Next slide, please, Grace. Just a quick review, lesson, questions. Go ahead, next slide. All right, so we spent the whole time talking about this one slide last time, and everybody should have a copy. I'm not going to go over this time. Just a reminder, we talked about this, what this means last week. And if you weren't here, you can go, like I showed on my website, you can hear what this slide is all about. Basically, this is a recap of what I talked about in a lot of ways the week prior. So, all right, next slide, please, Grace. And keep this reason I pass it out, because we're going to see some more charts as we go along. All right, just to sum what we did 2 weeks ago, historicis, if you remember, it's a forecast of the whole of history from Christ's first coming to his second and beyond. Also, the numerous symbols of the book designate various historical movements and events in the Western world and the Christian church. Is everybody tracking on that? Okay, so next slide. All right, can y'all read that? If you can't, you might want to move closer. Because I know everybody likes to sit all the way around the walls. But can you see this? This is basically, I took this right out of the ESV Study Bible, this chart here. Dennis Johnson put this together. Basically, it's a representative chart of the historicist position, not quite as in much detail as what I gave you. And I added this from the last time we looked at. So, but in your ESV Study Bible, these are good charts he has in there. They're not 100% accurate for everybody, but it's impossible to make them fit everybody. You know. So, but you see, it says chapters 1 through 3, letters to the seven churches, and arrow down to first century churches, right? And then here, chapters 4 through 19. So seals, trumpets, witness, women, the woman, and dragon, beast, bowls, harlot, and Armageddon. And then he has this, the millennium down here, because depending on whether you're talking, you know, post-mill or non-mill for this, you've got patristic, medieval, reformation, and modern age. So this is all the church age. And so all of 4 through 19 occurs throughout the whole church age. And they see events through the whole church age as being fulfillments of things foretold in Revelation, actual fulfillments. And then as you get to 27 to 22, 5, dragon destroyed, all in great rise, white throne judgment, all is new. They see that as the second coming, general resurrection, last judgment, and new heaven on new earth. It's pretty straightforward. I can see the attractiveness of that. Pretty straightforward on how that is. That's a pictorial representation of what we talked about the historicis was all about. Some strengths. We said makes Revelation meaningful for this generation in part. Strengthens faith, seeing the whole of history is under the control of God. Now, you remember they said that this was at one point the Protestant view. You know, remember, this is the view that had the Pope as being the Antichrist. When they, you know, that was in the original Westminster Confession before they nixed that. Weaknesses, not much use for the seven churches in Asia or early Christians. What good is it to them of all the, you know, if all this stuff happens on down the line? Almost entirely Western centric, mostly Western European. It really, all the things people are saying fulfilled through history is all stuff that really kind of pretty geographically centered in a small area considering the size of the world. And I added some from the last time we talked about it. Downplays John's time indicators. Mostly future outlook from John's day. So, you remember when I preached the other day, what did we say in Revelation 1 through 3 were the time indicators? Two words. Near and soon. This completely downplays this entirely, that all this is going to happen soon. Its adherents usually think Revelation leads up to their time, which is the end. So people who kind of hold to this thing think that the time they're living in, that's it. And, you know, every generation has to redo all of their math, basically. So it's basically in a constant state of flux as history rolls on with the constant revisions that have to be made. It's extremely subjective as part of this particular view. And Robert Mounts, he said, and he's from a historic pre-mill guy, he said, of little significance to its initial readers, the apocalypse was held to sketch the history of Western Europe through the various popes, the Protestant Reformation, the French Revolution, and individual leaders such as Charlemagne and Mussolini. So not a whole lot of, well, I should say scholars, really hold to that position these days. I'm sure there's some. But next slide, please. All right, now we're moving to the futurist. This is what you see more popularly. This is the position, say, Hal Lindsey's book way back came out, or the Left Behind series that you see. This idea that basically it's all in the future. As Michael Wilcox says, it is largely a prophecy of events still to come, even now. Robert Hillegon, he says, one who believes that the book of Revelation was written after AD 70. Then he says, he believes that all prophecy in the book of Revelation, beginning with chapter 4, has a fulfillment which is future to us. So he specifically says more chapter 4. And that depends on who you're talking to that's a futurist. Definitely chapter 4 for most futurists to own. It's all future. And we'll look at that in a bit. But next slide there. So futurism believes that chapters 4 through 22 refer primarily to events that will take place within history and usher in the eschaton. Grant R. Osborne, he says that. Any guesses what eschaton means? The end. The end. Perfectly put. The end. The end of all things. Christ's return. The end times. And then, of course, Leon Morris said, some hold that apart from the first few chapters, the book is exclusively concerned with happenings at the end of the age. They see the seven seals and all the rest as being concerned with the end of the world and as prefiguring those events which will usher in the second coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. So I think y'all are probably seeing a trend here for the futurists. Next one, please. With Kissenmacher here, he says the futurist interprets the apocalypse literally. I don't think anybody can possibly do that, but some people try. Literally, and I think that's probably more speaking towards dispensationalists that do. And considers the second part of this book as a witness to those times of the end when cosmic issues are at stake and when supernatural forces shall be let loose. And then Riddle Barger, a futurist is one who centers his theological beliefs around national Israel and believes that most prophecies concerning Israel are to have a literal fulfillment in the future after the Christian church has been taken out of the world. So any thoughts on that? I'm sure y'all have heard stuff about that. What kind of futurist stuff about the nation of Israel have you heard put out there as far as the importance of Israel getting back into position and doing what else? What else they got to do before the Lord can come again? They got to rebuild the temple. Sacrifices have got to start happening there. It's going to be all like it was way back before the temple was destroyed in AD 70, which makes absolutely zero sense. Why would they? I mean, Jay Adams talks about this duplicity. When you look at their schemes, it looks like it happens twice. It's because they have a tendency to take things that have already happened and put them to the future. So they've already happened, but they're going to happen again. So the temple needs to be rebuilt so chapter 11 can take place again and so on and so forth. Yes, sir.
What is, how do they interpret that the church has been taken out of the world? We just disappear or?
Are you talking about the rapture? They call that like the silent rapture.
Okay.
Boom. Jesus comes.
Secret rapture.
That's when all the planes start you know, if you're a Christian, don't fly an airplane because everybody's going to die if you get raptured and they don't. So, yeah. So anyway, it's that kind of thing. Honestly, to me, I think some of that future stuff, it really does sound like science fiction, but okay. Next slide, please. I've kind of mentioned it before, but there's two positions there, the historical pre-mill and the dispensational pre-mill position. George Ladd, he basically says the futurist view is taken to these two forms. You can call one the moderate and the other the extreme. The dispensationalist side, they're the extreme. But then he says a moderate futurist view differs from the extreme futurist view. At several points, it finds no reason, as does the latter, to distinguish sharply between Israel and the church. Now, what is that talking about? A distinguishing between Israel and the church. When you see in the dispensational side versus the, say, as we understand it from the Reform point of view, because you've got historical premill guys that are PCA pastors, PCA folks. But there's no way in the world they would ever embrace dispensational premillennialism because it's dispensational. But when this talks about distinguishing sharply between Israel and the church, and I haven't given y'all a class on dispensationalism, but you said y'all have had a few over at your church. Not that I'm pointing you out or anything.
A sermon or two.
You had a sermon or two. What do we believe Israel is? I have preached on this many times, and I'd be very disappointed if y'all let me down on this one. So,
true Israel?
Yeah, true Israel. What is true Israel?
All of God's
people.
All of God's people. Made up of who?
Us. Everybody that believes.
All of the elect.
Are the Jews part of true Israel?
If they believe.
Well, yeah. But what about the Gentiles? The Gentiles that love Jesus. Are they part of Israel?
Yeah.
So, true Israel is all the Christians, right? There's not some separation of national Israel away from the rest of the church. That's an artificial thing that is, it divides the truth. I'll use that terminology wrongly, because the scriptures teach that there's one Israel and that's all the believers. It doesn't matter whether you're Jew or Gentile, period. That's a big difference than some of the stuff you'll see and some of their writings and the way they understand some of these things. Next slide there, Grace. Thank you. So as we sum it up, the future is largely prophecy of events to come. Events from Revelation 4:1 on point to just before, during, and after Jesus returned to this earth. A prominent place of the nation of Israel, two camps, historical and dispensational pre-mill. We will probably touch on these millennial positions later in more detail, not today. But so that you can visualize what they look like, go ahead and click it. All right. First of all, we'll look at just the historical pre-mill. Like I said, there are plenty of folks, PCA pastors. This fits within the Reformed Orthodox view of things and largely does hinge on how they come to understand Revelation chapter 20, particularly the first six verses. So this historical pre-mill, remember Dennis Johnson put this together, took this right out of the ESV study Bible. Somebody said, I'm Army, right? They said, don't reinvent the wheel. So I give credit for credit's due, Dennis Johnson. So Revelation visions, chapters 1-3, first century churches here, okay, I understand that. And then notice chapters 4-19 here, and there's this gap, right? There's this gap. So remember, these are futures. These are futures. There's this gap. And they see Christian medieval reformation, modern church ages. That's not even covered. Revelation's like this big skip. Talk about these churches in 1-3. And then tribulation. Boom. Tribulation. And so in the tribulation times, way in the future, or could be, who knows when, chapters 4-19, seals, trumpets, witness, woman, dragon, beast, poles, harlot, Armageddon. All this tribulation, and then boom, second coming, believers raised, it's still part of Armageddon. And then the millennium, after Christ comes, there's a millennium for 1,000 years. Not 1,001, not 999, 1,000 years. Okay, I'm still in their position. Okay, and so then you move to 27 to 22:5, dragon destroyed, all in grace rise, light throne of judgment, all things new. which is the general resurrection, last judgment, and the new heavens and the new earth. That's a general historic pre-mill position. Very intelligent, wise biblical scholars hold that position. I happen to disagree with it. And if you look at your chart that I gave you on mine, you can probably tell a little bit of difference, but I'm not going to make you sit there and compare it at this point. Go ahead. Any questions on that? Any questions on that? I'll read you what Dennis Johnson said on it. He said, for many futurists, these coming events include a 7-year period of intense tribulation, chapter 6 through 19, followed by a millennium, 21 through 6, in which Christ will rule on earth before the general resurrection and the inauguration of the new heaven and earth. So when I say the millennium, Christ is reigning on earth. He set up, he's got his throne, he's physically there. That's kind of the direction that goes there. No questions? All right, next slide, Grace. So this dispensational premill, and I have debated back and forth whether when we come to looking at millennial positions more and more detail, whether we even talk about this. I may not. I may just say, if you want to know, go look, because it's so bad. It's just so bad. Dispensational premill. Y'all can read that. Can you? Okay. So we've got chapters 1 through 3, letters to 7 churches, first century churches. Okay, but notice he has an asterisk there, right? Some dispensational interpreters think the churches addressed in chapters 2 through 3 predict different periods in church history. That completely takes it out of having any actual historical reference at all. Think about that. And then there's a big gap, like there was in the last one. That's the church ages, all things happen patristic all the way through now. And then you see this arrow from this edge here going here, boom, rapture, believers raised. That's what you were talking about. That would be that secret rapture, well, silent rapture, where when all the Christians are taken, boom, airplanes falling out of the sky. And so, tribulation now. Everybody's left. Well, now you're going to have a real hard time. Tribulation. All Christians are gone. They said bye-bye. Y'all have fun. And so now tribulation has kicked off. Chapters 4 through 19 goes through all of that. I'm not going to read all that for you again. And then we move to second coming. Boom, wait. There's another one.
Third, second, third.
How many of these are there? So second coming, Armageddon, there at the end. And then millennium. Christ reigns 1,000 years. And then 27 to 25, God destroyed. Judgment, general resurrection, last earth, judgment, new heaven, new earth. Comments, thoughts? Because I know some of y'all know a lot about this.
Well, I've always thought that the secret rapture, when I heard all that, I'm like, where did I get this in the Bible? It's just not there.
No, it's not.
It's just completely made up.
Yeah. It's.
I've never figured anything about it either.
Now, I know most of y'all have got to have seen this before, because it's just too popular out there. This is like, there are a lot of people that have some general popularized understanding of Revelation. This is kind of what they have in mind.
Yeah, but somewhere in the New Testament of the Christians going to meet Christ in the air, where is that?
Well, we talked about that one.
Is that part of
it? Sir?
Like 1st or 2nd Thessalonians.
Yeah, right, and
that's where they get it from. I don't know.
There is, Mark, and as a matter of fact, but the thing is, as you read that, this idea of meeting Christ in the air, you're meeting Christ in the air, but it's you're going to him like a delegation to then come with him as he descends to earth in the final coming. As you read that, what we talked about this in the sermon the other day. The way the language is there, remember when we were talking about in Acts where Paul was going, he was heading to Rome, right? And all the Christians came out from, or not all of them, but a lot of Christians came out were meeting him. The exact same terminology is there. This is they went out to meet him and then to greet him, and they all came back to Rome together. This is the exact same type of language that's used there to refer to us going to meet him and then come back with him as the whole body of Christ together descending the earth. Which is a great picture, because I think we see that in Revelation too.
So where is Israel?
Actually, they're quite prominent in that.
Yes. But I will say that the dispensational position has the church as a parenthesis.
Almost, the church is almost like Plan B.
Yeah, that. Yeah, some of the stuff I read is pretty disturbing. It's almost like Jesus failed. And because of that, okay, we had Plan B, church. All right, he's going to come back later. He's going to put it to him again. It's going to work out next time. That's how I understood it. I mean, would you agree? Would you say that's kind of it, what it's saying?
Yeah, I mean, Israel is like, it's extremely prominent. And if you remember, I think maybe some of the reasons they're having to redo some of their theology is so much of it was predicated on Israel becoming a nation again in 1948. And they said, now, Jesus gives the, in Matthew, talking about, he tells them, when you see the fig tree blooming, you'll know the time is near. And they've taken that passage to believe that that's talking about Israel, that after it becomes a nation, you know, and then that whole, this will all happen within a generation. But now Israel has been a nation for 70-something years.
A long time.
Very long time. That's usually much longer than the typical generation in the Bible. And so they're having to redo something.
You know what the whole point of abomination and desolation? Why was it desolate? Why was the temple desolate?
Because of the abomination.
God had left. When Jesus left the temple in Matthew 23, literally and symbolically, the Lord exited the temple. He was gone. From that point on, no longer was it my Father's house. It's your house. Father is gone. I mean, you can see his language change how he refers to the temple. When he left, the Lord left the temple. Gone. Abandoned. And then the abomination of what used to be holy comes along, and we talked about that in all of it this Lord. But see, here's the thing. Even if they rebuilt the temple, the Lord's not in it as his special house anymore. Where's the temple of God? We are. He's in our hearts. The scriptures are clear. We are the temple of God. Even if they rebuilt it, it would just be a big building, a monument to the old. It would have no, I mean, it's not like the Lord's presence would be a part of that. The Lord brought judgment on that whole system. He ended it. There's no need to rebuild the temple and go back to having offerings and all these kind of things. Only if you separate the nation of Israel from the rest of the Lord's people, when you have two Lord's people, would that make sense. And that's what they do. Where we've got Christ, he's our perfect sacrifice. So I guess, you know, if you're the nation of Israel, you've got to have sacrifices. Am I going along the right track there?
Yeah.
So, very strange stuff. All right, so next.
Was the passage you were talking about with meeting him in the air is in 1 Thessalonians 4.
1 Thessalonians 4, thank you, JT.
But it can't be a secret rapture because the dead in Christ will rise first and there will be a loud trumpet cry.
So, the dead in Christ rise first, loud trumpet cry.
Then those who are still alive will meet.
Unless it's not really a loud trumpet cry. It's a silent, loud trumpet cry. So, anyway. Futurist discussion. Thoughts? Have you run into this view before?
I like that about how it impacts political positions. Because think about...
How about how it impacts political positions? Yeah, how does it, JT?
Just think about... our American alliance with Israel, so many conservative Christian people in America who might fall into part of this camp think it's necessary for us to support Israel so that they can be reestablished and get all this going so we can get the second heaven.
Exactly. There's this huge evangelical push that's very pro-Nation of Israel. Now look, I will say that Israel is our ally, and because they're ally, we treat them like they're an ally. But the religious motivation behind it is so that the nation of Israel over there, that they've got to do a bunch of stuff, and if we help them along, Christ will come back sooner. I'm sorry, that's not the way it works. But have you seen that kind of thinking? Have you heard? I've seen head nod. Y'all heard that kind of thinking? We need to help Israel along so Jesus will come back sooner.
Even recently, what did Trump do that was so big?
Oh, he moved the capital to Jerusalem.
The embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah, well, we were over there shortly after that. And let me tell you, the Jews were extremely happy. They love Trump. He brought the capital back to Jerusalem. Even then, I would say that from a standpoint of them being allies, it was promised by, a few administrations before Trump. Trump was merely fulfilling a promise.
Yes.
Which, regardless of the evangelical motivation, you know, the dispensational influence type folks, despite their motivation for their encouraging the nation of Israel, it's the right thing to do because they are our ally. I mean, we have to remember, the United States is allied with them. That means they support us, we support them. It's just that's how allies work. What else? How does it impact the Christian outlook? This futurist point of view that basically it's all in the future sometime. Versus other things that we've talked about, particularly to remember what we talked about last week.
The destruction of the temple and stuff kind of, and I think you pointed this out, kind of symbolizes God having left there completely.
Yes.
The fulfillment of his covenant.
That's exactly right. The old covenant is done. We're now under the new covenant. The New Testament, Christ said he brings is in his blood. New covenant is blood. That's exactly right, Chris. So, to go with this idea that the nation of Israel's got to kind of get their temple back and all that kind of stuff, you're talking about them coming back under the old covenant stuff, right? And that's... It doesn't make sense. The old covenant is done and over with. We're in a new covenant now. So there's confusion on that, but they're not covenant. See, that's another thing. Dispensationalism is very much not covenant theology, which is what you've been raised in. So it makes, you know, that, you know, so you pick up on that.
So dispensational theology, God changes. And we know that God doesn't change.
God does not change.
It's everywhere. He's unchangeable.
There you go. All right, so strengths and weaknesses. Any that y'all can think of, strengths and weaknesses on the future position, and not just dispensational. They're real easy to beat up on. Historic premium.
Well, at least they see Christ coming and reestablishing and saving his, taking his people back. There's a second coming, even though it might be twice. We're getting to the same end point. That God's people are with him in heaven forever. It's just that we're a little confused on what's going on before that. So the strength there is getting the victory.
Getting the victory. And I will agree with that. God wins. God wins. Jesus wins. Yeah. That's a strength. They're consistent on that. Any other strengths or weaknesses y'all can think of?
I think they would argue, I don't agree with it, but I think they would say it's strength. And, well, if you think this is all happening in the future, you'll be more observant and pay attention and, you know, be ready if you think these things are coming.
Right. The strength of futurism is real good because they pay attention that there are things to come in the future. So we're not going to get to preterism today, but the preterists, like the full preterists especially, they say it's all been done. All the prophecies were fulfilled way back in AD 70. Nothing left to be fulfilled. That's kind of depressing, you know, really. And it's very unorthodox. That's why partial preterists aren't that. They have a view to the future. And I think that as we read Revelation, it's justified to have a view to the future. But how we get there are a couple of different things. Whereas, as you look at the view I talked about, a lot of the stuff in Revelation was inaugurated and is ongoing to be consummated at the end. Also, as we read Revelation, we understand it's a prophecy. We see that, like prophecy, there's things that occur that happen consistent with that time frame then that were fulfilled during that specific generation when the prophecy was given. Times are soon, near, so on and so forth. And then some of those things are going to have an even more fulfillment or even future fulfillment, like prophecies. Remember we talked about Isaiah 7 with the virgin birth pronouncement. But some strengths, Gentry, believe it or not, he's very much a partial preterist. He said, futurists argue that their view allows a more literal approach to Revelation's prophecies, making the book easier to interpret. He said, well, they consider that a strength. Okay. It provides us with an outlook of what to expect at the conclusion to world history and the final fulfillment of all prophecy. And he said, maintains a continued relevance in that the events of Revelation could begin breaking out at any moment. And so I think that who spoke to that, that be ready. Jesus said he's going to come back like a thief, right? This takes that very seriously. He's going to come back, boom. And that's a lot of ways how they fit the whole rapture thing. That's going to be the big surprise coming. And from there, it's pretty much sketched out. Now problems, and Morris says this, for all intermediate generation is merely a forecast of what will happen in the last days. And then until those days come, it means little, except that God has an ultimate purpose. That's why I run into so many people that they say they're pan-millennials. You know, if the emphasis has always been future, well, you know, it has nothing to do with me. It'll all pan out in the end. So there's no need to even bother studying this stuff. Right? I know y'all have come across that. I certainly have. Why bother studying if it doesn't have anything to do with me until the future? So there is that whole relevance aspect of things. Now, there is a caveat that G.K. Beale makes to Morris's quote where he says, however, the historicists, like the historicists, the futurists may contend that the book would have been relevant to the first century audience since Christ's coming has always been expected imminently and that even first century readers could therefore have thought the visions about the final great tribulation were potentially quite pertinent to them. So y'all understand what he's saying there? In other words, it'd be a bad idea to say this isn't relevant to us because these things could be imminent any time, and the imminence is often stressed. And it would have been imminent, and that's how they say it would have been relevant to the first century churches to whom it was written. It would have been imminent for them at that time. That's kind of what he's saying. So, and then Gentry says, almost totally removes the relevance of Revelation from John's original audience, and at a time of their great suffering. And adds Morris, indeed, for all subsequent generations right up to the last. He was writing to people who were suffering, who were undergoing persecution, who were lots of uncertainty, a lot of things going on. And to write them a letter that really didn't speak to anything specific that's going to happen and be fulfilled and say it's soon and near, I think somewhere I read somebody said, that's cruel. That'd be cruel. Why would you do that? You know, they give them all this hope, this is going to happen, but nothing happens, nothing happens. No. I mean, it was written to us, it says to us. You can see where that goes, right? And so it requires the current day reader of Revelation to reinterpret its phenomena, which meant something in John's day, to make it fit in modern times. Must wholly overlook Revelation's claims of the nearness of the events, despite their introducing and concluding the whole work. If y'all remember, I spoke about that a couple of weeks ago in the sermon, Revelation 1:1, 3, and 22, 6, and 10. You know, so the book opens with near and soon, and it closes with near and soon. So we need to look at that. What does that mean? And we'll eventually get there, Lord willing. Often involves exegetical subjectivity. After all, new technologies will arise that will require a reinterpretation of Revelation's imagery. Helicopters, remember? Locusts or helicopters. Yeah, that one. So that's out there. But
you know that the wheel in Ezekiel is UFOs, right?
The wheel in Ezekiel was UFOs. Fantastic. they need to come back. Maybe they've got some great technology we could put to use that will solve this energy problem that we seem to have, like Texas is shut down right now. Any other questions?